Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Since February 14th, we've spent considerable time on this program talking about mass shootings in America and how to prevent them. We've spoken with mental health specialists and education leaders. We've had guests who express thoughts on faith and culture and the contemporary role of the Second Amendment and what we can do to protect our gun ownership rights while also protecting our children and ourselves. Tim Bjorkman is a former judge of South Dakota's 1st Judicial Circuit. He's currently running for U.S. House. He recently released his thoughts on what he calls common sense gun law reforms on his campaign website, timbjorkman.com. The important thing, he says, is for us not to turn our backs on the topic, no matter how much we disagree on the details. Tim Bjorkman joins us now to discuss some of those details. Judge Bjorkman, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, Lori. Thanks for having me again.
About the experience that you've been having, but on this show I've been having the experience where I find people are very frustrated by this problem, but they're also very hungry to have a conversation about it. Are you seeing that people really want to be talking about this, don't want to stop talking about it until they feel that we've moved forward? What are your thoughts?
I do think this is the moment to have this discussion. It's been put off way too long. It's a really tough subject, Lori, and that's why I think none of our congressional delegation or the other leading House candidates have come out with a plan of their own. It's destined to create people on both sides of the issue who will oppose anything that someone proposes. But really, if our children are important to our future, how can this not be an issue that merits our thoughtful, respectful discussion, and in a way that's unimpeded by the special interests that affect the issue?
I want to start with some of the research and what we know and what we don't know. And when you go on to Tim Bjorkman's website, you'll see an actual list of steps that he thinks are important for us to talk about. And number seven is, importantly, removing the ban on CDC studying firearm violence. And we had Dr. Holm on this show who was talking about that. How much does the ban on the CDC researching gun violence affect what we know, what kind of data we currently have about what works and what doesn't work?
Well, that's the imponderable that we'll never know for sure, Lori. But we have had to rely on private research sources rather than our own federal government providing us with reliable information to help us solve one of our biggest problems. So anything that throttles information and that helps answer questions for us, I think it's a real detriment. Because if this government is really up by and for the people, then the people are entitled to have the best minds looking at this in an impartial, nonpartisan way and let us have some research on it. So we really lost 20 years of data, I think.
Right. And the criticism was that it was politically motivated, that the research itself was flawed because of its political motivation. Do you think that that's a concern?
Well, it's hard to get away from political influence in any aspect of American life today, and that's probably always been the case, Lori. But if that were true, then why do we have any government research? Why not just abolish every source of research? Why do we have a congressional budget office, if we think all of the data it generates is political? I think that's a cheap argument to make by people who don't want to get the facts out.
Do you think that gun violence is a public health issue?
Well, I think the data clearly shows that it is. We've had more people who have died from gun violence just since 1970 than in all American wars combined. And the vast majority of those, two-thirds of them, are deaths by suicide. So we clearly have an enormous problem. We wouldn't tolerate a foreign enemy killing that many of our own citizens. Why is it so easy to accept the deaths of school children, the deaths of women in domestic violence situations, even male-on-male homicidal deaths or suicides at those rates. And at one level, there's some interplay between all of these. You know, we have a very we have a sick part of our culture that needs help, needs some attention, and in one sense, they're crying out for help. The data clearly shows that.
As you sit down and sort of figure out some of what you call, you know, first steps toward addressing the problem of mass shootings in America, you look at more than one thing: research, background checks, mental health. You know, you call it a war on mental health. A war on mental illness, I should say. Tell me a little bit more about what kind of commitment you think Washington needs to make about mental illness and how that would affect South Dakota with its very specific geography as well and some of those challenges that we face.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting, first of all, that some of our friends on the other side of the issue point to mental illness as the chief cause of the gun violence, yet the majority in Congress has employed its efforts to reduce mental health funding and take away access to mental health care for millions of Americans, which is a provision of the Affordable Care Act. So I think that's the first thing. We have to look at how we get affordable health care for every American citizen, Lori. And the people that I saw as a judge who I ended up sentencing to prison almost invariably struggled with an addiction. 90% of those in our prison system today in our state have an addiction, and the vast majority of those have underlying unaddressed mental health issues, problems that they couldn't get treatment for before they came into the system. So we look at and are dealing with mental health care in this state in a very penny-wise and pound-foolish way. We're paying dearly. It's killing our workforce. We don't have enough people to do the jobs that we need to have filled all across the state, and the political leaders are scratching their heads trying to figure out how we get more people to do the work. Well, these people are in our prisons and they're underemployed because they're struggling with a lot of mental health and addiction issues and a lot of work ethic issues that grow out of that. Now, we have, I think, according to Kaiser Family Foundation, 15% of the necessary mental health providers in South Dakota. We have the lowest percentage of mental health care providers per capita of any state in the nation, Lori. Number two isn't close. So we have a particularly acute problem here. And that's in no small part attributed to the fact that there's not a market for those providers, because we have 40 to 50,000 of our citizens, our fellow South Dakotans, who don't have that kind of access to health care, because they may be working, but their employer doesn't provide health care coverage. They're not eligible for Medicaid because they don't have a child in the home, and they don't earn enough to qualify for the American Health Care Act coverage. So it's a serious problem. When I speak about declaring war against mental health, I think it has to involve all of these aspects. We've got to create opportunities to get these people into health care early. We've got to work to continue to destigmatize healthcare treatment in this state and nation, and we've got to just do a better job of caring for our vulnerable population, especially young children who grow up in some cases in really tough family situations, and we're not doing enough to protect them from growing up in despair and really lacking hope and lacking friends and feeling a part of the community. So, you know, it's a problem that needs our attention from multiple directions.
As I have followed different conversations from tuning in to President Donald Trump's meeting with congressional leaders, where he said things that surprised many people, to going back and talking to people just in my circle of friends and family, I've often been surprised at some of the things that they've been willing to consider As far as solving this problem or different ways that they come at the problem, when you're in South Dakota and you're listening to people on the campaign trail, what has surprised you with what South Dakotans are saying to you about this issue?
Well, I think the vast number of people agree with me that our primary goal has to be to keep guns out of the hands of people who have a demonstrated propensity toward violence. You know, the goal that I had in these proposals was to craft proposals aimed at keeping our communities and our children safe without trampling on the rights of the vast majority of lawful gun owners. And I think we can do that with a series of the proposals like the ones I made. I don't pretend to have all the answers here, but I think these are some first steps that should reach some broad consensus. That was my goal. Let's see what we can agree on that we can get pushed forward.
And we've talked about a few of those, you know, removing the ban on CDC studying firearm violence, committing our nation to war on mental illness. Let's talk about some of the others so folks know exactly what you're laying out, some of the other highlights to what you're proposing.
Well, the first common sense thing is we need a law mandating uniform background checks on all gun sales, not just gun sales that take place with dealers. And so one of the obstacles to private gun sales going through the background checks is the cost. It can be anywhere from $15 to $30, $40, $50 based on reports I've gotten from different people who've had to go through that. And I think one thing we can do there as a government is to offer that private background service free through law enforcement offices. And that'll maybe take some federal funding to help make that happen. But that's just, a good thing we can do to make sure that we're encouraging those private transfers to comply with the law. And then another thing is, I think a legitimate exception to the background checks are when guns are passed on in an estate. We have a lot of gun owners in South Dakota who have quite a set of gun collections, and leaving those to responsible family members should be something they can continue doing. But the other thing we have to do with regard to uniform background checks is beef up the sharing of information, state, local data points, so that those are being shared with the federal database in a very efficient way. The Texas killing mass shooting a while back wouldn't have happened had that kind of reporting taken place. So I think there's a lot we can do just to identify the people who shouldn't be having guns and keep them from being able to buy them privately or at gun shows.
And you have not advocated for a ban on assault-style weapons or, you know, weapons like the AR-15, but you are looking at things like the bump stock. How come? Why make those distinctions?
Well, first of all, again, my goal is to get a set of policies that can have some broad acceptance. And I think, you know, the sides can debate assault rifle ban or ban on clips beyond a certain number of rounds. Those are all issues to be argued over, but that are more complex, and I think they're the kind of thing that would benefit from, frankly, from research on CDC data. Let's see what all that says, but we're probably not going to resolve those issues today, but there are some very important things we can do, and that's the focus of this article. What can we do now to get some safeguards in place? And I think, you know, what I hear more than anything else, Lori, is parents of children talking about how they go to school scared every day.
Right, right.
You know, I've had reporters, judges, and just, you know, people across the state telling me that they're concerned for their children. And I'm old enough to remember the bomb shelters back in the early 60s and the atomic war fears. And it's quite a thing to allow our children to go to school frightened every day and for us not to put our heads together to come up with some common sense things we can do right now to make them safe. And so that was the purpose of this writing. We know that, you know, the vast number of gun deaths don't happen with assault rifles. They happen with handguns. And you have handguns and other kind of rifles you can make into automatic weapons, too. So, I mean, it's a much broader issue than banning one kind of rifle, because when they did that in 94, the modifications to the rifles to get around that exception came out very soon after. Much more difficult.
Explain to me what red flag laws are and how they might be implemented, or how we might agree they could be implemented.
Right. Well, red flag laws are just laws that allow a court to temporarily remove guns from a person who poses a danger, and requiring that upon removal, that individual goes into the mandatory database reporting. And then they provide for a process by which that person can regain the right to possess weapons once the harm is alleviated. And, you know, we already have a system in place within the states, including South Dakota, for protection orders. And if a person is convicted either of a misdemeanor or felony domestic assault, or has a protection order for domestic violence placed against him or her, that person is banned under federal law from possessing a firearm. But the interesting thing about the domestic abuse protection order and stalking process is that if a person has a concern against one individual or a couple of individuals, you can get a protection order if you can prove that there's a risk of harm that meets the statutory showing. But we really don't have something equivalent for someone who just poses a great risk of harm to a broad set of people, like a school shooter. And one of the things that's so striking is in 60% of the mass school shootings, Lori, someone knew the shooter was going to carry out the assault. So we've this type of person that we need to intervene with. We just need a process to act quickly, have an affidavit submitted that a judge would review, and if there's sufficient showing in the judge's view to warrant it, the guns could be temporarily collected, and a due process hearing could follow in a matter of days thereafter, where the parties could each be heard, call witnesses, and have lawyers present if they chose to.
How important is school culture and sort of the things that happen within the school building? We talked to two principals last hour about, shooters who turn their anger on a school and what can be done to sort of reach out and make sure everyone is heard in a school environment before something escalates. Part of what you think about overall?
That was one of the proposals I had, is to encourage the school interventions like the Sandy Hook Promise, which is focused on that kind of student. You know, we just leave so many kids out. They're isolated from other kids. They may be isolated from their own family because of inattentive parents, parents unable to or unwilling to care for them. So the Sandy Hook Promise focuses on that kind of intervention to reach out to those kind of kids and help them with addressing their needs, bringing them more into the circle of other kids, and really trying to diffuse problems before they happen. Mm-hmm. I was struck by, along those lines, Lori, by an article my wife showed me, by a man who's in his 30s now, but he wrote that he himself was almost a school shooter. And because his wife and kids were asking how somebody could do that, he decided, you know, I have to tell my story. And he wrote that he was very much an outcast himself in school. He had a chaotic childhood with a lot of violence. He moved from place to place. The people closest to him were the ones who hurt him the most. And he went to school, but he smelled bad, either because his clothes were dirty, or he hadn't showered in weeks, and he was picked on. He was bullied, He didn't play sports, and so he said, I got angry, and I started hiding weapons, and I decided I was either going to kill myself or kill other people. And, you know, it took the intervention of someone who just loved him. And in his case, he said, I was planning on killing myself when a friend baked me a pie and threw a gathering for me. And he said that saved my life. We have all these kids out there like that, and we have some grown-ups out there like that, too, and they do teeter between suicide and homicide sometimes. That's why we see the spike in suicides among not just juveniles but all Americans. We were talking about that a little earlier, and so these issues kind of merge when people are rejected and are without hope for a future. They start to dwell on some really harmful things, and we need to do a better job of taking care of one another.
Tim Bjorkman, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much. We hope you'll come back again.
Thanks for having me, Lori.